We'd like to start. We have, as it is now, perhaps a little less than an hour, and we'd like to give them as much time as possible. Our topic for this session is Whitehead and Mormon Theology. The paper will be presented by Professor Floyd Ross, who's professor of philosophy at California State Polytechnic University at Pomona. He's formerly of the Southern California School of Theology, where he taught comparative religion. One of our special guest lecturers at the symposium, very pleased to have him here. Following Professor Ross's remarks, we'll hear a response from Professor Sterling McMurrin, who's the E.E. Erickson Distinguished Professor, an adjunct professor of philosophy here at the University of Utah. He's also author of The Theological Foundations of Mormonism. Of the Mormon religion, I believe. Is that the correct time? Thereafter, if there's any time, we'll welcome questions from you. And Professor McMurrin, if you will field those questions, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Let me make just a few personal comments first. I am not essentially a theologian, although I had 3 years training in a school of theology before I drifted over into philosophy. I am a teacher. What I'm going to present to you today, in less than 45 minutes, I hope, I would normally spend at least 3 periods on in a class at the university, allowing time for discussion. Whitehead is not an easy subject, but I have knocked out 9 pages of my original paper, and that can be read separately if any of you are really that much interested. You probably know the old distinction between a theologian and a philosopher. They're both looking for a black cat in a dark room, and the black cat isn't there. But the theologian always finds a cat. The philosopher may find hemlock, which is a drink slightly more dangerous than Coca-Cola, I understand. Theologians are honored sometimes by being sainted 200 to 500 years after their death. That goes for such persons as Paul and Augustine and Aquinas and Ambrose and so on. Philosophers are sometimes fired, or more importantly in our time, unfortunately just ignored. So I speak for a breed that is not, shall we say, in the ascendancy in American culture, but I teach philosophy and I am interested in religion because that's been my life. Now, the subtitle of this paper, and normally I don't read a paper, that's not my style, but I had to do it for this learned audience. Subtitle is A Statement of Some of the Key Ideas in the Writings of Alfred North Whitehead as They Might Have Relevance for Mormon Philosophers and Theologians. Over 40 years ago, I visited Bryce Canyon, almost 50 years ago, as a matter of fact, and I went out walking after dinner with a young waitress who proved to be a Mormon. And when I paused to give her a hand to go down some steps, instead of taking my hand, she put a copy of Elder Woodsoe's book, Irrational Theology, in my hand. That was my first introduction to Mormon theology. I don't know whether Mormon girls still carry Elder Woodsoe in their pocket or not and use that strategy, but I still have that paperback. And I read that book. Now, I was turned off by some of the details. The man seemed to know more than I wanted to know. But I was excited. I was excited by some of the ideas in that book. And I'm still excited by some of the ideas in Mormonism. I did further reading on Mormonism later at the University of Southern California, where I had to show that I knew something about it because I had many Mormon students in my comparative religion classes. And I went on working my way, as it were, through many areas of religion. And I might say that in the meantime, since I'd gotten interested in philosophy and did my doctoral work at Yale, I ended up first in India, studying Hinduism, and eventually ended up in Japan, where not only did I get enthralled with the Japanese way of life, but also married a Japanese wife. Now, latterly, I began reading something of your own eminent philosopher, Dr. McMurrin, and the idea came to me that there are bridges between Whitehead's process philosophy and some of the deeper intuitions of Mormon thought. And possibly there can be a marriage performed. Whether it will be sealed today or not is another matter. Now, I'm an amateur on Whitehead, as on many other things. That is, I study Whitehead and philosophy because I love it. I'm not a professional interpreter of Whitehead, as Charles Hartshorne, for example, is. He has quite a reputation for that. But I'm intrigued by Whitehead. Now, I didn't give out an outline, so I'm going to tell you some of the main points that I'm going to talk about. And most of the quotes are from Whitehead. Fortunately, you're going to be spared 78 footnotes that constitute 5 pages of this. You can read that later, too, if you're not entirely bored. The first point I want to talk about, and this will be from Whitehead's point of view, is why rational religion needs philosophy. You may say this is just special pleading, but I happen to think Whitehead makes a good case. When we look at the history of religion, as far back as the evidence extends, we find there has been much irrational religion. Even to the present day, this history, says Whitehead, is a melancholy record of the horrors which can attend religion. Human sacrifice, the slaughter of children, cannibalism, sensual orgies, abject superstition, hatred as between races, the maintenance of degrading customs, hysteria, bigotry, all can be laid to its charge. And then he adds, religion is the last refuge of human savagery. The uncritical association of religion with goodness is directly negatived by plain fact. But religion which is rational must have recourse to metaphysics for a critical scrutiny of its terms and its dogmas, says Whitehead. Religion, when it is too much under practical pressures of any sort, forgets this enriching role played by the philosophical spirit. Philosophy begins in wonder and continues in wonder, whereas theology tends to often end up simply comforting us. And there's not much comfort in philosophy in the early stretches. Philosophy is not vitiated by this weaker human urge to seek comfort. Philosophy teaches humility in the presence of the ultimate mystery, but it is not the kind of mystery which makes of its devotee a cringing, fearful supplicant, but, says Whitehead, the mystery which by its fascination lures men on to action and to further speculation. This is the mystery of the creative process at which we do not cease to wonder when we find that we share its work. So the business of philosophical theology, according to Whitehead, is to show how the lure of persuasive reason arises in a world which seems to be based on the clash of senseless compulsions. We are invited by him to think of religion and of history essentially as an experience of growth. In the Occident, religion has often been equated with a belief system. It has been equated with a specific code of morals or believing a specific book, Torah, Ten Commandments, laws of the Quran, and so on. But Whitehead sees religion in a much deeper dimension. The basic religious insight, he says, is that religion is that the order of the world, the value of the world, in its whole and in its parts, the beauty of the world, the zest of life, the peace of life, and the mastery of evil, are all bound together, not accidentally, but by reason of this truth, namely, that the universe exhibits a creativity with infinite freedom and a realm of forms with infinite possibilities, but that this creativity and these forms are together impotent to achieve actuality apart from the completed ideal harmony which is God. He adds, the peculiar character of religious truth is that it explicitly deals with values. It brings into consciousness that permanent side of the universe which we can care for. Religion's final principle is that there is a wisdom in the nature of things from which flow our direction of practice and our possibility of the theoretical analysis of facts. What about the mystical or revelatory elements found in religion? Whitehead would have us remember that all so-called scriptures, at their best, are but finite attempts to communicate some important experience or insight in verbal symbols, human symbols. What about mysticism? He says mysticism leads the individual to try to create out of the mystical experience something that will save it, or at least save the memory of it. Words don't convey it except feebly. We are aware of having been in communication with infinitude, and we know that no finite form we can give it can convey it. Periodically, in religion as in the sciences, someone comes along who has some great intuition, some new awareness, usually called revelation in the Semitic tradition. These insights or revelations are not cases of seeing something particular in its particularity. They are cases of seeing something from a totally new perspective, in a new pattern of relationships, and with a richer dimension. A good example from science would be the case of Copernicus. Copernicus found himself thoroughly dissatisfied with the astronomers of his day because they'd invented over 80 cycles and epicycles to keep dear old Ptolemy's cosmology going. And this was frustrating to him. And suddenly an insight came to him. What if I stood on the sun? What if I assumed that the sun is at the center of the universe? That's what I call a great idea, a great intuition. And on the basis of that, he worked out a whole new cosmology. Now notice, he happened to be wrong on certain points, as Newton and later Einstein were to show. But at least with that great idea, he set the tone for a whole new kind of cosmology. And Kepler, who was one prominent defender of his viewpoint, probably wouldn't have defended that so much if he hadn't himself been a kind of sun worshiper at heart, because it took all the traditional astronomers several decades to accept the fact that maybe Copernicus was more correct than Ptolemy. If you want an example from biblical tradition, I refer to the book of Hosea. Hosea's wife proved unfaithful. He found her in the marketplace plying her trade as a harlot, and yet he discovered that he still felt love for her. And suddenly a great intuition came to him. Surely God loves Israel, who has played the harlot, even as I love my wife Gomer. This is more what Whitehead has in mind when he talks about great intuition. Not revelation we see in words, but a new insight, a new dimension. Now, to be sure, the problem for the person who has this new insight, or revelation if you want to call it that, is how to interpret this awareness in such a way as to make it exciting, persuasive, evocative, and thus available to a larger audience. Each of us must come out of his privacy or solitariness to try to communicate something of what we have seen or intuited. Here is the problem as well as the challenge for philosophical theology. Now, it's obvious that Whitehead then does not believe in propositional revelations, that God has propositions that he reveals to us. All propositions, of course, like all books, are man-made. They are our feeble attempts to interpret something that eludes our grasp. As one of your own philosophers, Dr. McMurrin, has pointed out, modern thought has tended to be suspicious of the abstract and the recondite. This has often been true in the past of new perspectives. From that of original Buddhism, and the Buddha refused to discuss metaphysical subjects with his disciples, to the beginnings of Christianity in the first century. But eventually, the thoughtful human mind is forced to venture into the arena of metaphysics, cosmology, and the philosophy of religion. Otherwise, says Whitehead, we may lose ourselves in fantasizing over the details of particularities in our propositions and our dogmas. Whitehead insists that we should not put too much stress on the particular modes of statement, for they are all finite, subject to error. We should rather be lured into mining the depths of the great idea to find ever-enlarging insights of universal import. We would do well to follow the example of Plato, who wrote, "We must be well content if we can provide an account not less likely than another's. And we should be satisfied to ask no more than a likely story." In modern scientific language, we substitute the word model or paradigm for his likely story. A new model will always throw more light on wider areas of experience or reality. That's what Copernicus's model did over Ptolemy's. It's what Einstein's model of the universe has done over Newton's. Nietzsche talked about the tendency of religious people to believe in their own beliefs, and added that cryptic statement, "For me, a sandwich is better than that." Whitehead talks about our human tendency to slip into the fallacy of dogmatic finality. The universe is vast, he says. Nothing is more curious than the self-satisfied dogmatism with which mankind cherishes the delusion of the finality of its existing modes of knowledge. Karl Popper, a great contemporary thinker in the field of the philosophy of science, has pointed out how all knowledge is finite. No matter how many finite bits of knowledge we accumulate, our ignorance will still be infinite. We are engaged in an unending quest which demands the use of all of our faculties to arrive at increasing verisimilitude, that is, the appearance of truth. Notice Whitehead does not talk about certainty. There's no such thing as certainty in this finite orbit of ours. Though we will never know the real truth, the whole truth, yet are we always drawn irresistibly to the quest for it. This is the essence of the process point of view. We achieve no triumph of finality, says Whitehead. Our metaphysical knowledge is slight, superficial, incomplete. Thus error creeps in. But such as it is, metaphysical understanding guides imagination and justifies purpose. Apart from metaphysical presuppositions, there can be no civilization. Thus, he adds, we will always have a variety of partial systems of limited generality. Whitehead points out that this doctrine of dogmatic finality flourishes equally throughout theology, science, and metaphysics, often. He adds that the development of systematic theology should be accompanied by a critical understanding of the relation of linguistic expression to our deepest and most persistent intuitions. The ultimate appeal is to intelligence, to reason, to the rational faculties which can check the more extravagant utterances our emotions sometimes lead us into. Certainly this is a Whiteheadian note that Mormon thinkers should find thoroughly congenial. Here are Whitehead's words. The appeal to reason is the appeal to the ultimate judge, universal, and yet individual to each, to which all authority must bow. History has authority so far and exactly so far as it admits of rational interpretation. For Whitehead, there is no place for authoritarianism. In the words of Elder Widsoe of Bryce Canyon fame, a rational theology is founded on truth, on all truth, and truth has no end. In building a philosophy of life, a man therefore cannot say that some truth must be considered and other truth rejected. Only on the basis of all truth, that is, all true knowledge, can his religion be built. It is impossible for a man to be saved in ignorance, he quotes. A man is saved no faster than he obtains knowledge. The glory of God is intelligence, and intelligence is the pathway up to the God. And in the words of Sterling McMorrin, the primary task of theology is the reconciliation of the revelation to the culture, to make what is taken on faith as the Word of God meaningful in the light of accepted science and philosophy. Mormon theology has in the past pursued this task with some consistency and at times with intellectual strength, and certainly with a stubborn independence and indifference to criticism from traditional thought. Today, much of that strength is gone as Mormonism suffers the impact of religious and social conservatism, as the Mormon mind and the general pattern of contemporary religion yields to the seductions of irrationalism, and as the energies of the church are increasingly drained by practical interests. Creativity is an ultimate in Whitehead's thought. The universe itself is a creative advance into novelty. Nature is never complete. It is always passing beyond itself. Rigid dogmas will always destroy larger truths, and Whitehead places the emphasis upon rigidity. The same idea was expressed long ago by the Buddha. Anything, when clung to, falls short. If you try to swim by clinging to the water, you're going to be at the bottom of the pond or the pool. You learn to swim by throwing yourself back in the water and having faith that you'll be able to stay up. You can't cling to the water and learn to swim. Our minds are finite, says Whitehead, and yet even in these circumstances of finitude, we are surrounded by possibilities that are infinite. And the purpose of human life is to grasp as much as we can out of that infinitude As long as we experiment, as long as we keep this possibility of progressiveness, we and our societies are alive. But when we lose them, both we and our societies are dead. Nothing is easier to lose than this element of novelty which keeps all alive. The second point, the proper use of dogmas and the perils of dogmas. The word dogma originally meant simply opinion. Then in Greece it came to stand more especially for a philosophic opinion. Whitehead points out that the Greek physician Galen used the phrase to mean physicians who guide themselves by general principles, surely a praiseworthy practice. It was later that the word came to stand for officially approved dogmas, doctrine, and it was this usage which led theologians to fall into the trap of their own limited ideas. Properly, says Whitehead, the foundations of dogma must be laid in a rational metaphysics which criticizes meanings and endeavors to express the most general concepts adequate for the all-inclusive universe. This means a dogma is the precise enunciation of a general truth, divested so far as possible from particular exemplification. Though a one-sided formulation may be true, it may have the effect of a lie by its distortion of emphasis. For example, it is still possible to navigate ships using Ptolemy's cosmology, but you would never get astronauts on the moon. Furthermore, an ill-balanced zeal for the propagation of dogmas, says Whitehead, bears witness to a certain coarseness of aesthetic sensitiveness. It shows a strain of indifference to the fact that others may require a proportion of formulation different from that suitable for ourselves. Perhaps our pet dogmas require correction. They may even be wrong, he adds. Such indifference may be due, perhaps, to arrogance, perhaps to rashness, and perhaps to sheer ignorance. Dogmatic expression is necessary. For many people, such formulations increase vividness of apprehension, and it thus can provide a kind of aid in the difficult task of spiritual ascent. But Whitehead adds, every individual suffers from invincible ignorance, and a dogma which fails to evoke any response in immediate apprehension stifles the religious life. The function of dogma is to evoke a creative response, you see. Many fine religious people are upset by the suggestion that dogmas may have to be modified, as Whitehead sees very well. For such persons, intermediate representations, another word he uses for dogmas, play a great part in the religious life, being enshrined in modes of worship, in popular religious literature, and in religious art. But, he adds, dogmas become idols when they are allowed to dominate the scene, and the great intuitions which inspire them are forgotten or neglected. Whitehead adds further, religions commit suicide when they find their inspiration in their dogmas. Any dogmatic system of thought presumes to answer too many detailed questions that are not genuine questions. Priests, both in science and in religion, can pretend to know more than they actually do. When a priesthood becomes dominant in the society, says Whitehead, freedom of inquiry is discouraged, and if their dominance continues long enough, the level of general intelligence is depressed. Whitehead illustrates this point by reference to the scientific priesthood around the time when he was at Cambridge University in the 1880s. Mathematical physics, all the way from Descartes through Newton, looked sound and solid. But by the turn of the century, 15, 20 years later, nothing, absolutely nothing, was left that had not been challenged, if not shaken, not a single major concept. That experience of seeing Newtonian physics blow up, Whitehead came to consider as one of the supreme facts of his experience. And he adds, there is no more reason to suppose that Einstein's relativity is anything final than Newton's Principia. The danger is dogmatic thought. It plays the devil with religion, and science is not immune from it. The next point, the importance of accepting change. Change is the process and is itself the actuality, says Whitehead. This is a crucial point in understanding Whitehead's viewpoint on science and on religion. Science seemed to have learned a lesson since the turn of the century, but, says Whitehead, religion will not regain its old power until it can face change in the same spirit as science. Its principles may be eternal, but the expression of those principles requires continual development. Neither science nor religion can avoid this need for continual development. A history of theology reveals that what is accepted as orthodox in one period may be regarded as heretical in another. Whitehead cites the example of Father Petavius, a Jesuit of the 17th century, who showed that the theologians of the first three centuries of Christianity made use of phrases and statements which, since the 5th century, would be condemned as heretical. Now, most theologians tend to be timid, says Whitehead. Now, I admit, they can be very brave, too, because they're always fighting rearguard actions, often not out in front, they're back there in the rear resisting change. But Whitehead says, theologians are afraid of a clash of doctrine, but a clash of doctrine is not a disaster, it's an opportunity. And the most important question then becomes, in what spirit are we going to face the issue? Sam Wood has paraphrased that great Christian hymn that I learned as a boy in Methodist Indiana, "Like a mighty army moves the church of God, brothers, we are treading where we've always trod." That isn't the way I learned it. But Whitehead feels this can happen in theology and it can happen in science. In what spirit are we going to face the issues, he asks. It is not possible, nor is it desirable, that there be identity of detailed belief. In fact, we should be suspicious of beliefs that have been spelled out in too much detail. In one place he says, exactness is fake. Pretty strong language. But the diversities of belief may arise from differences of stress exhibited in metaphysical insight and from differences of sympathetic intuition respecting historical events. Such diversity is to be expected and respected. Amid these differences, it is possible for rational persons to reach a general agreement as to those elements in intimate human experience and in general history which we select to exemplify that ultimate theme of the divine immanence as a completion required by our cosmological outlook. But we should always be more concerned with the qualitative aspects of religious facts than with the various explanatory formulations. Never swallow anything whole, he adds. We live perforce by half-truths and get along fairly well as long as we do not mistake them for whole truths. But when we do so mistake them, they raise the devil with us, he says. Change is constant, and whether we measure it by minutes or by millennia, we ourselves are part of it. We have been brought into existence in a certain quarter of the universe in consequences of its processes, and there's no reason to suppose that other types of existence, unimaginable to us, have not been produced elsewhere in the universe. Any system of thought based on this earth of ours is extremely limited in its conceptions, theology or philosophy included. We now know that our earth is an insignificant planet, not insignificant to you and me, I'm sure, swinging around a second-rate sun in no very important part of the universe. The human response to that knowledge should be immeasurably larger than it is. And he says, I see no reason to suppose that the air about us and the heavenly spaces over us may not be peopled by intelligences or entities or forms of life as unintelligible to us as we are to the insects. In the scale of size, the difference between the insects and us is as nothing to that between us and the heavenly bodies. And who knows, perhaps the nebulae are sentient entities. This was said in a dialogue in his Harvard home after he had retired from teaching, but it shows how his imagination could still lead him on beyond all of his scientific and mathematical training. And then he adds, my point is that we are part of an infinite series, and since the series is infinite, we had better take account of that fact and admit into our thinking these infinite possibilities. The next point, the importance of a pattern of existence, or a model. These first comments are mine, not his. The human mind seems to be so constituted that it looks for pattern or order in the nature of things. The mind is a part of reality, and it's the nature of the mind to try to find order in reality. That's the way we're put together. This is reflected in the ancient thought systems of Persia, China, Japan, India, and Greece. In Greece, the pattern by which things moved was called Logos. In ancient Persia, Asha, or Artha. In ancient India, Rita, from which comes our word right, R-I-T-E. In ancient China, it was called the Tao. In ancient Japan, Kami-no-michi, or Shinto, the way of the divine. In modern science, it's referred to by such neutral language as the axiom of intelligibility. We assume that the universe is intelligible without remainder, and we haven't the slightest evidence to support that beyond what we know about our tiny corner of this little galaxy of ours. According to Whitehead, this desire for such a pattern grows out of our wish that our experience should have some meaning, some order, that is, it should make sense. The hypotheses of science are the same. The pattern may not represent anything more than our conception of our lives as we would like to believe them to be, or our hypothesis of a scientific process, but it steadies us. How we treat our hypotheses or models varies considerably. Scientists have latterly learned to be much more venturesome than traditional theologians. The scientists have been welcoming hypotheses which destroy their previous assumptions, and they welcome them as a condition of advance. For example, Karl Popper rightly points out that the scientific method basically is the method of falsification. You try to falsify your favorite hypothesis, and if it stands up, you've got an idea that it approaches verisimilitude. Now, by contrast, says Whitehead, the theologians, and I consider Christian theology to be one of the great disasters of the human race, if the theologians admitted that their assumption has been upset, they would consider it a major defeat for themselves, even when all the while their position has been shaken and so altered that the tenets of today would, in certain intellectual circles, be hardly recognizable as those of the same or similar people 70 years ago. Now, when Whitehead refers to Christian theology as being, quote, one of the great disasters of the human race, he is referring primarily to the traditional Semitic idea of God, particularly the Christian idea of God as omnipotent, all-powerful. This is a bit of macho, I think, but he doesn't use that word. He admits that gracious and merciful insights are to be found in the history of Christian doctrine. But he says, they are there by flashes, and they were based logically on the most appalling system of concepts. The old ferocious God comes back, the Oriental despot, the Pharaoh, the Hitler, with everything to enforce obedience from infant damnation to eternal punishment. Sounds like an immature male trying to hold things together. We need to look briefly at Whitehead's criticism of the earlier traditional forms of Christianity. Incidentally, he had tremendous appreciation for the gentle Jesus of the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount, but not too much appreciation for many of the so-called great names of Christian theology. The early Christians were grossly misled by the eschatological models used by Peter, with his Jewish background of popular apocalypticism, dating from the time of Daniel at least, perhaps even back to Zechariah, and Paul, an educated man who ought to have known better. Whitehead says, on the whole, the gospel of love was turned into a gospel of fear. The Christian world was composed of terrified populations. In flaming fire, take vengeance on them that know not God, and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. Whitehead is quoting from 2 Thessalonians, of course. And Whitehead adds, the population did well to be terrified at such ambiguous good tidings, which lost no emphasis in their promulgation. Now, when it comes to the Middle Ages, Whitehead points out that institutional Christianity was honorably distinguished as a driving force toward the grander intuitions. But unfortunately, in accordance with the habits of all institutions, Salt Lake City excluded, of course, it adapted itself to its environment. It became an instrument of conservatism instead of an instrument of progress. With the Protestant Reformation, there was a short burst of progressive energy, but the Reformation churches, says Whitehead, again accepted the same idolatrous role. On the whole, well-established religious institutions are to be reckoned among the conservative forces of society. They soon become the grand support of what Clement of Alexandria termed communal custom. But the ultimate ideals of which they profess themselves the guardians are or should be a standing criticism of current practices. Another unfortunate consequence of the Reformation was that reformers like Luther and Calvin help to fixate on large sections of Christendom the old concept of a divine despot and a slavish universe, each with the morals of its kind. Unfortunately, a more enlightened man like Erasmus lacked the force or drive to lead the movement of reform. So, says Whitehead, the matter fell into the hands of Luther and Calvin, who made a fearful botch of it. Not all Protestants will agree with that evaluation, to be sure. Furthermore, he says, Calvin and Luther made the egregious blunder of throwing away the whole aesthetic appeal of the church, which was one of its best elements. They also had no use for the idea of purgatory, one of the more realistic and gracious teachings of the medieval church. As a university professor, I tell students when they get an incomplete, they're consigned to purgatory and it has to be made up within a year, but can't they be glad that there is purgatory? Whitehead says flatly, the Reformation seems to me to be one of the calamities of history. For, here's his reason, any attempt to present God under the aspect of power should awaken every instinct of critical reaction. Remember, both Luther and Calvin believed in an omnipotent God and double predestination. Only a tiny few would be saved to even up the ranks of the angels in the choir, according to one of those little insights Augustine pulled out of thin air somewhere along the line. Whitehead expresses sorrow that the Bible should end with the book of Revelation, with its picture of a God of power, ready to smite in wrath. In its place, he would have preferred to see the funeral oration of Pericles, with its plea for tolerance and for the rule of persuasiveness. Next, a brief statement on Whitehead's concept of God. And there are 9 pages I've omitted at this point, so forgive it if it seems compact. God is one of the 3 basic formative elements in Whitehead's philosophy. On the philosophical empirical side, the evidence pointing toward a God is derived from the ordering element in the cosmic process. Now bear in mind, Whitehead was a scientist through and through, and knew all the latest theories of science, quantum theory included. He says, there is too much observable order in the universe for atheism to be a rational choice. How do you explain the presence of order? And he says, there's too little order and progress in the world for the traditional concept of an omnipotent God to be plausible. So he's basing his teleological argument upon an empirical approach. There are 2 main objections to the doctrine of divine omnipotence. I understand Mormons still flirt sometimes with the idea of an omnipotent God, but if I read the records correctly, that is a gloss. Number 1, the first is a conceptual one. The very idea of power presupposes some resistant force over which power is effective, but such a counterforce, itself embodying some degree of power, is denied by the claim that one being possesses or even could possess all power. Hence the concept of an all-powerful God is self-contradictory. The second objection is based on the reality of evil. Evil exhibits itself in physical suffering, mental suffering, loss of the higher experience in favor of the lower experience. And while the general aspect of nature is that of evolutionary expansiveness, the question persists, says Whitehead, as to why there is so much unproductive experimentation, so many disastrous divergencies, so much failure and loss. Evil is real, and it has the character of being a destructive agent among things greater than itself. Evil, says Whitehead, is a positive force but destructive, while what is good is positive and creative. Evil promotes its own elimination, either by destruction or by degradation, downgrading of itself, or by elevation, by being lifted up by the good. But evil in its own nature is unstable. And, says Whitehead, the fact of this instability in evil is the moral order of the world. If God were in all respects infinite, he would be evil as well as good. God has in his nature the knowledge of evil, of pain, and of degradation, but it is there as overcome with good. God's pervasive presence in the world is a lure toward higher forms of order. Whitehead never believes in a God who coerces. God lures us. God tries to persuade us. This is the kind of language he always uses. While God's aims are universally active, their realization is not guaranteed. Thus, for God as well as for man, the future holds both opportunity and risk. God is complete in the sense that his vision determines every possibility of value, and every event on its finer side introduces God into the world. The world lives by its incarnation of God in itself.
God in the world is the perpetual vision of the road which leads to the deeper realities. God is the binding element in the world. The consciousness which is individual in us is universal in Him. The love which is partial in us is all-embracing in Him. God is the mirror which discloses to every creature its own greatness. God's purposes in the world have no power except that of persuasion. Now, having grounded the actuality of God on a philosophic argument based essentially on the element of order in the world, when we talk at all about this God, we lapse into poetic expression, as shown by most of Whitehead's comments that I have just quoted in the preceding paragraph. We should take such poetic expressions seriously, but never literally. The function of poetry, he says, is at least twofold: to reveal something to us that prosaic language cannot express, and to move us to appropriate some significant experience. Whitehead invites us to imaginative generalization which combines the evaluative acuteness of the human organism with the cognitive activity that keeps us from lapsing into trivial sentimentalism or misleading literalism. The faith in the order of nature makes possible the growth of science and of rational religion. But this faith springs from direct inspection of the nature of things as disclosed in our own immediate experience. There is no parting from your own shadow. To experience this faith is to know that in being ourselves we are more than ourselves, to know that our experience, dim and fragmentary as it is, yet sounds in the utmost depths of reality. Make a few concluding comments, and I'm sorry I can't develop them or even lengthen this. Looked at broadly, Mormon thought and many of the ideas of Whitehead seem to have much in common. I'll list just a few. One, there's no basic conflict with the sciences or with the scientific method as such, if one knows what he is about. Mormon thinkers are inclined to go into a lot of details about the cosmic plan, pre-existence and post-existence, and Whitehead would be very, very agnostic on such activities. Number two, both shy away from absolutisms. Maybe institutions don't, but the principles do. And both accept pluralistic entities within an overarching oneness. Three, both recognize that rationalism, empiricism, and intuition all have their place in a worldview that is empirically grounded. Such, each recognizes the importance of imaginative generalization. Four, each accepts the idea of God's finiteness or limitedness. And each recognizes that everything is related to everything else, including God. In philosophical language, the universe is a universe, not a pluraliverse. And all things are internally related, even though we understand only a tiny portion of those relationships. Number five, in place of the view, old view that the universe, and especially the human beings in it, are subservient to God as slaves or abject creatures, there's a recognition of co-creativity. In every event or occasion, there is the possibility of new departures, new insights, and new intuitions. Six, there's a positive estimate of matter, of the human body, of all actual entities, to use Whitehead's phrase. Neither matter nor human nature is downgraded. Seven, the whole universe is becoming. It's in process, in change, including God. Since God's consequent nature preserves all the new creations of all actual entities in the universe, God is growing, and his consequent nature is different from his primordial nature. Eight, on the question of individual post-existence, Whitehead remains silent, but he does feel that there is an objective immortality of all values in the consequent nature of God. Nine, one of the most important common elements is the stress on intelligence and the appeal to rationality. Religion should never be allowed to degenerate, he says, into a decent formula wherewith to embellish a comfortable life. The doctrines of rational religion aim at being that metaphysics which can be derived from the supernormal experience of mankind in its moment of finest insight. I close with two quotes. One from Whitehead's Science in the Modern World. Religion is the vision of something which stands beyond, behind, and within the passing flux of immediate things. Something which is real and yet waiting to be realized. Something which is a remote possibility and yet the greatest of present facts, something which is the ultimate ideal and the hopeless quest. The other quote is enigmatic. I've taken it from the Oriental tradition, And tonight, as you try to get the conference out of your bones, think upon this and see if you can find an answer. To search after God is to be like the person who walks in circles trying to see his own eyes. Those who understand this, walk on. May we be among those who walk on. Thank you.
Have a brief paper which comments on Professor Ross's statement. I'll read parts of it and leave some of it out because of the problem of time. It is both a privilege and pleasure to respond to Professor Ross's excellent paper on Whitehead, his process, philosophy, and Mormon theology. It's fortunate that the invitation was simply to respond to the paper rather than to criticize it. So I can find nothing substantive that merits or warrants criticism. Professor Ross has a firm grasp of the fundamental character of Mormon theology and is obviously very much at home in treating Whitehead's cosmology. And his insight and wisdom in bringing attention to the value of Whitehead's metaphysics for those interested in the refinement of Mormon theology are an indication of his own high competence in matters of religion and philosophy. Certainly, as Professor Ross has clearly shown, important fundamental similarities obtain between Mormon theology and Whitehead's metaphysics. Those who are seriously interested in the future of Mormon theology can do no better than to follow what appears to be Ross's implicit admonition that they should take a good look at Whitehead. Common Mormon treatment of the problem of reality as process is dogmatic, it's inadequately reasoned, and is philosophically crude. While Whitehead's treatment of reality as process is perhaps the high watermark of 20th century philosophical refinement, his great work, Process and Reality, is rightly regarded as one of the most difficult and the most abstruse philosophical treatises ever produced, a quite remarkable contrast to the simple Mormon commonplaces regarding such matter as growth in God's experience and eternal progress. But as Professor Ross has indicated, the two have some common ground, and at some points there may be actual identities. Whitehead's work is highly speculative, but it grew out of his vast knowledge of post-Newtonian physical science and is the product of the mind that, with Bertrand Russell, produced the Principia Mathematica, the supreme monument to the abstractive powers of the human intellect. Even some of his personal friends were dismayed when he turned in his later years from philosophy of science to speculative metaphysics and philosophical theology, for he clearly moved beyond the firm ground of experience and laid himself open to the empirical and positivistic charge of meaninglessness. For our interest here, however, we should face the fact that those who are genuinely sensitive to the problem of the validation of truth claims must meet the same criteria for factual meaningfulness, whether those claims are grounded in revelation, scientific investigation, frank speculation, or just plain daydreams. Whether a proposition is true or not has nothing to do with how we got it. It has a great deal to do with our justification for keeping it. The problem of being and becoming has been one of the most persistent and difficult issues in Occidental metaphysics since the pre-Socratics, and as Professor Ross has elsewhere shown, it has been a major issue in Oriental thought. How something can continue to be what it is while at the same time changing into what it is not is a problem that was exacerbated by the Aristotelian logical principles of identity, contradiction, and excluded middle. And the decision to go in the direction of being, with its commitment to perpetual identity and timelessness, or in the direction of becoming and temporality, with its risk of ontological instability and irrationality, has been a fundamental problem in metaphysics since long before Aristotle rejected Plato's conception of the independent reality of universals in his effort to account for the reality of motion, change, and development. Mormonism was born in the century that undertook to overthrow the grip of being and timelessness, which Christian orthodoxy had fastened upon the Western mind, an orthodoxy that derived largely from the Platonic conception of being. Especially in European thought in the 19th century, the century of the beginning of Mormonism, the new commitment to movement, growth, and temporal process changed the character of intellectual culture. This can be seen in such romantics as Schelling, Goethe, Wagner, and Nietzsche. But its most impressive symbols are Hegel and Darwin. Hegel's attack on the foundations of Aristotelian logic through his conception of dialectic, which was not divorced from his own metaphysics, had, whatever its limitations, a powerful impact on the development not only of metaphysics and religion, but also on politics and history. But it was Darwin's empirically grounded arguments against the concept of fixed species that more than anything else destroyed the traditional faith in the absolute unchanging character of the world. In the work of William James and John Dewey and their associates in this country, and of Bergson and the vitalistic biologists in Europe, and finally of Whitehead in both England and America, we can see the coming to some level of maturity of this vision of reality in process. Now, I have the impression that Professor Ross finds some favor with Mormonism at this point. That is, in its refusal to settle for a finished world, its restless sense of creative process and temporal movement. I personally believe that this is the most interesting and attractive facet of Mormon theology, and what might be called the Mormon metaphysics. And I fully agree with the implicit suggestion of Professor Ross's paper that the Mormon theologians might well take a very active interest in Whitehead, who is clearly the philosopher of process. Literate Mormons have for many years found support in William James' finitism, pluralism, and vision of the unfinished universe. James is easy to read and Whitehead is difficult, but it is time for those Mormons to give Whitehead their serious attention. Considering the intense temporalism of Mormon theology, a quality now threatened by some writers of considerable influence who lust for the fleshpots of Christian orthodoxy, I misread that. So you're going to have to take back your laugh. Start over. Considering the intense temporalism of Mormon theology, I wrote this in the middle of the night in bed. Considering the intense temporalism of Mormon theology, a quality now threatened by some writers of considerable influence, who shall not here be named, whose lust for the fleshpots of Christian orthodoxy seems to know no bounds, the Mormon theologian should find much encouragement in Whitehead's statement in Adventures of Ideas, where he says, "I hazard the prophecy that that religion will conquer which can render clear to popular understanding some eternal greatness incarnate in the passage of temporal fact." That emphasis upon temporal fact, which is important. I'm going to skip a couple of pages here and just refer to my closing comments because of the time. recent years, I just want to mention this, in recent years there has been a noticeable discomfort in Catholicism with the scholastic foundations of dogma, especially the metaphysics of Thomas of Aquinas, in favor of a fundamental philosophy that accommodates process better than the scholastic Aristotelianism. And of course, in this movement, the interest in Whitehead's metaphysics has been very strong, though of course Whitehead was an Anglican and not a Catholic. Mormonism has the great advantage of not only an initial break with orthodoxy, but also of an almost total lack of sophistication in metaphysics that would tie it to the philosophical traditions of the past. In this, it seems to me, it is in a somewhat more felicitous condition than those religions which are deeply rooted in the past intellectual formulas that may now be scientifically outdated. The trouble is that some official Mormons seem to be unacquainted with official Mormonism and are now endangering its very finest insights. Now, in conclusion, I was pleased that Dr. Ross called attention to the attempt of Mormonism to be rational, especially by his reference to the work of John A. Widsoe. I personally believe that Widsoe did more than any other Mormon writer of the past to stress the importance of rationality in religion. Even though his own efforts at times produced strange and even grotesque results as he attempted to square Mormon dogma and biblical literalism and reason and science. Those of us who are Mormons, of course, are well aware that anti-intellectualism and irrationality abound in profusion in Mormonism, and that in recent decades things have been getting worse rather than better. But Professor Ross is entirely right in calling attention to the Mormon ideal of rationality. I was also pleased that he gave attention to Whitehead's treatment of the problem of evil and the finitistic conception of God in both Whitehead and Mormonism, and to their common stress on freedom and creativity. But most Mormons and some Mormon theologians seem to be unaware of the finiteness. In his concluding comments, where he compared Mormonism with Whitehead, Professor Ross was at times, I am afraid, somewhat too generous with Mormonism. As, for instance, when he said that both Mormons and Whitehead shy away from absolutisms. That Mormon theology is in principle basically non-absolutistic, and that even Mormon ethics is in certain respects non-absolutistic, does not at all mean that the generality of Mormons do not have strong absolutistic tendencies. On the whole, they are infected with the absolutisms that are common to all types of conservatives. They are much the victim of the language and diction that have been produced by all forms of past orthodoxy. They are seduced by their own discourse, which appeals more to emotion than to reason. But Professor Ross has excellent insight into the character of Mormonism and a fine sense of the similarities of Whitehead and Mormonism. Now, whether Whitehead would agree with this is an interesting question. I am aware with respect to the same, I don't know whether Whitehead ever encountered the missionaries, or if he did, what happened between them. I've never heard. I am aware, however, with respect to the same kind of issues which Ross has exploited in the matter of Mormonism and Whitehead, that Professor John Dewey recognized some similarity between his own philosophy and Mormonism, and that even William James had some feel for the pragmatic facets of Mormonism. James, as most of you would know, included Joseph Smith in his great Gifford lectures, The Varieties of Religious Experience. I don't mean to put Whitehead, Dewey, and James in the same philosophical category, but there are important points of agreement among the three on those very issues which Professor Ross has brought to our attention. I personally believe that Ross's paper should be widely read by those who are interested in Mormon theology. I take it for granted that someone will publish it. I will be greatly surprised if it does not have a large impact on Mormon theological speculation in the future. It is the careful and acute observation of a person of profound religious insight whose wisdom is the product of very large experience and extensive learning. I'm referring to Professor Ross. What I'm saying would fit Whitehead nicely as well. Those Mormons who read the Ross paper with care and understanding should gain from it a greater appreciation of some of the better elements of their own theology, to say nothing of its value in refining their conception of religion.